Welcome to the Real Estate Show, sponsored by Capital Square Realty Advisors. We are thrilled to have world-class economist Dr. Peter Linneman on the show.
Dr. Linneman, I once made the mistake of printing your bio on my little home printer, and I needed to add paper. So after receiving both your master's and doctorate in economics under the tutelage of Nobel Prize winners plural, Milton Friedman and others, Dr. Linneman had a distinguished career at both the University of Chicago and the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Linneman is practical in his analysis and advice. He literally wrote the book on real estate investment, publishes a quarterly newsletter, the Linneman Newsletter, and hosts regular webinars. Google Linneman Associates for more information. My firm, Capital Square, engaged Dr. Linneman to study the economic and demographic data before launching the apartment REIT. It's a great honor to have Dr. Linneman on the Real Estate Show. Welcome.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. If I didn't know the person you're talking about, I think I'd be impressed.
But Capital Square buys apartments, medical office, industrial in the Southeast and Texas, and it's jobs that are creating the demand, especially for multifamily. If you would, tell us about the job growth in Southeast and Texas.
Let's face it, great job creation. And let's take Texas first. It's simpler. I wrote a piece, again, for Linneman Letter, I don't know, about 8-10 years ago. And remember, I'm 70 years old, and I grew up with the Beach Boys singing about California girls, and California being where all dynamic, exciting things were happening in the 60s, right? And at least so it seemed. And I said that if you were to do that again, it would be about Texas. And Texas likes entrepreneurs. Taxes are low. Building restrictions are relatively low, which means housing costs are relatively low. So if you said Houston, what is Houston's greatest amenity? Low housing prices. Low, whether it's rental or ownership, low housing prices. Why is that a great thing? If I'm an employer, I'm not trying to pay crazy wages on products sold all over the country and world, paying crazy wages because building restrictions make it impossible for real people to have a home, right? So Texas is going to continue to generate jobs because they want jobs. I mean, I don't know how else to make it any simpler, right? They want jobs, and they really want jobs. They behave like they want jobs. And I'd say that generally categorizes most of the South Southeast if you leave out California, Southern California. You can find exceptions, but most of the South Southeast, include Texas in that, want employment. They don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk. Right. And yes, they have taxes. Everybody has tax rates. Everybody has regulations, but they don't view business as the enemy. And if you don't view business as the enemy, it's not a surprise you're going to get more jobs.
It's very basic, but you talk about residents moving for the low cost of living and quality of life. That makes a lot of sense. And then you say businesses move for low input cost, ample labor, educated workforce, and efficient transportation. It's not rocket science, right?
You know, that we've done some rocket science statistical studies of job growth over a decade, over two decades, and the studies were rocket science. You know, really powerful statistical methods and carefully tweaking the data. But you just said it. When it's all said and done, all we did was document what you knew to start with, which is if you make it an attractive place for people to live and you make it an attractive place for businesses to do business, you'll get growth.
And big companies, right? Big companies.
Yep. And there is a wild card. The wild card we found on job growth, I think is interesting. That is, imagine if Bill Gates had been born in, I don't know, Chattanooga and lived in Chattanooga and was loyal to Chattanooga rather than Seattle. Well, that would have meant that instead of Seattle getting all that Microsoft boost, Chattanooga would have gotten it. And so there is, neither of us are saying it's all purely statistical. If Les Wexner had not lived in Columbus, Ohio, the Limited and all the things that went with it wouldn't have happened. People forget Cleveland boomed at the turn of the 1900s because of John David Rockefeller and oil and in Cleveland, right? And all those entrepreneurs. So there is that kind of special element, but most of it, as you say, is just pretty simple. If you make it attractive for people and you make it attractive for businesses, you'll get jobs.
Here's a brain twister. Do you know the nickname for Chattanooga?
No, that's a great question.
Gig City.
What is it?
Gig.
Gig. Interesting.
They have phenomenal publicly accessible internet in Chattanooga.
Interesting. No, I didn't know that. This is why I love to talk with people. I learn.
I only learned it becoming one of the largest buyers in Chattanooga. So
it's a good market. You know, it's one of those, overlooked markets. What do you pick up? You probably pick up 25 to 50 basis points on cap rate, right?
Yes.
And Freddie and Fannie basically lend to you at the same rate as they'll lend to you anywhere else. And the credit of the people in the building is as good as if those people were in, I don't know, New York, or namely a doctor's a doctor, right? A dentist is a dentist. An accountant is an accountant. They may not make as many dollars, but from a credit point of view, they're just as good. And a doctor in Chattanooga is as good a credit to pay their rent, right, as a doctor in New York is to pay their rent. And so people overlook that. So the Chattanoogas, the Birminghams, and the credit is as good there as it is anywhere else. And you pick up 50 basis points on the cap rate and you borrow at the same rate. You do that math, it's pretty attractive.
GM thinks enough of Chattanooga to build all their electric cars there for the future.
Yeah. So, which could be, it won't be in the next year, but could be over the next decade, huge. I mean, gigantic, right?
Gigantic. It'll be gigantic. Let's use that thought to shift into the demographic shifts that favor multifamily. There are a lot of changes that you've observed in your Linneman letter. You would educate us on the demographics that impact multifamily.
Well, everybody points out the millennials are aging and everybody points out the boom, et cetera, and so forth. What you've got, I think, in a simple way, we cover the numbers in Linneman letter. I think the simplest way to think about it is over the next 5 to 7 years, most of the millennials that have the capacity to own will be moving out of their prime renter years into their prime owner years. And you say, uh-oh, a lot of millennials. However, right behind the millennials are Generation Z. And when you look at their number of them coming in versus the number of millennials going out, it is just not much different. It's just not much different. Little lower, but not much different. And the reason I say a little lower, remember, it's net growth. It's not like it's shrinkage. That was the problem with the baby bust. The baby bust was net shrinkage. The Gen Z is still net growth. And yes, development may slow a little bit, but that'll keep things in balance. And then on the other end, you've got boomers who, not all of them are going to downsize by any stretch of the imagination. Not all of them are going to downsize.
But some
are going to downsize. And you can pretty much identify where they're going to downsize to. There's one, they're going to downsize and probably rent in an area very close to where they've owned all those years, if you will, right? Because that's where their network.
Their children, not going to leave their children.
Network, their friends, that's one. Second is some, and they get a lot of publicity, are going to move to the urban core that has, as long as the urban core can maintain safety, that's a question. Some of them move there because their kids are gone. And one of the things that chased them to the suburbs was schools being so bad, right? And of course, once their kids are out of school, they can move back. So that's a second, but that's not the overwhelming. And then some are going to move to places that are more welcoming in terms of weather, and particularly if they've got friends. So that's, that's Florida. Florida, right? And to some degree, the Carolinas, and to some degree, Arizona, depending where you're at. And there's a lot of boomers. And the downsizing phenomena gets overstated, but it is real in the way we just talked about.
And they have money and they don't need a job.
boomers over the next decade are going to be the healthiest, wealthiest, most time available generation in the history of mankind. That we're healthy, we are wealthy. I wish we were wise, right? But we're healthy and wealthy and still alive, which no generation ever in the history of mankind has been in those years. So it will be interesting to follow the boom. And I think they're going to be big renters in certain markets.
Tell us about home ownership. That seems to play into the multifamily demand story.
I think single family is going to continue to do well for a while because it was so massively underproduced for so long. Like for 20 years, it's been massively underproduced to the tune of about 3.5 million homes over the last 20 years in total. And if I told you you underproduce something by 3% and 4% of the stock, you'd say there's going to be a lot of upward pressure on prices. And, you know, you've got the millennials moving into a period of wanting them. So I think single family can do okay, do well. But it doesn't mean multi will do badly. Multi also has been systematically underproduced by about 600,000 to 800,000 units over that same time period, which is why rents, one of the reasons rents have run up is it's also been underproduced. And multifamily will continue to do well. Single family had a great last year. And the reason is rather bizarre. We wrote about this in Lindemann Letter, I think the last issue. The biggest problem for someone buying a home.
The deposit.
Research I did in 1990 with Susan Wachter from Wharton was the down payment. That's the biggest inhibition. That's the biggest prohibition. I can make the monthly, but I can't make the down payment. Think about what happened during the pandemic. First of all, you had nothing to spend your money on. So suddenly, instead of using your money to go to the ball game or going to dinner, you had nothing to buy. Suddenly, you had money piling up with nothing to do. And people looked around and said, oh, I actually have enough for a down payment. And so you had this spurt of what I call involuntary savings that created the opportunity to buy a home. But as consumption goes back to normal, that will disappear. The second thing happened was you had a lot of people 70 years and older die well before they would have otherwise died because of COVID. That's very sad. But people inherited a lot of money sooner than they expected ever to inherit it. What did they do with the inherited money? They bought homes because they suddenly got the money for a down payment. So you had this spurt created by COVID deaths and by nothing to spend your money on that created down payment capacity. Now think what happens looking forward. Even though COVID cases are up, deaths are not up notably. I think if you were to say, do you think early deaths are going to be prevalent over the next year or two? I'd say no. So that the early inheritance part is gone. And then as things come back that you can go to the ball game and take a holiday, and maybe it's not the ideal holiday you wanted to take, you are spending money again. So you don't have as much money down. So people are getting down payment constrained more so as you move forward over the next year or two than they were during COVID.
Did you say we were over 700,000 housing units short?
700,000 multifamily,
multifamily
and about 3.5 million single family.
You're the economist. What happens when there's a shortage?
Prices go up. Prices go up.
I could have told you that, and I don't have a PhD.
I know. Hey, listen, I studied with Nobel Prize winners, so when I say it, it has weight. When you say it, it just sounds like a guy saying it, right? No, but it's not that hard. When you have a fundamental undersupply, and demand grows, prices rise. And that's why you're seeing rents rise and home prices rise at the same time, right? It's not like you're seeing home prices rise and rents falling, right? They're both doing pretty well.
Let's talk about our last topic for this session. The Treasury's pumping trillions of dollars into the economy. It looks like there's another $1 trillion coming. They could be 3.5 to 5.5 more trillion coming. if you would, educate us on inflation and what history has proven to us about multifamily housing during inflationary periods.
All right, so let's start with the last part first. It's proven to be a very good hedge against big inflation. And all I mean by that is I don't think multifamily or almost anything hedges against a 0.5% increase. And I don't think multifamily hedges if the inflation rate is 2.4% versus 2.3%, right? But it does hedge big inflation. That's one result. And again, that was some research I did years ago. Second is, people say there wasn't much inflation from 2010 to 2019, and there wasn't of consumer prices, but there was enormous inflation of asset prices, right? Stock prices went up, bond prices went up, gold prices went up, apartment prices went up, et cetera, right? And that's because all that money that got created during the financial crisis, it chased assets. And that's because the banking system of today is set up to lend to asset buyers much more than goods and service buyers. Now, we put even more money than we did during the financial crisis in the financial system. And my view is it's going to come out. And it's going to come out sometime during the next decade, probably during the next 5 to 6 years. And it's going to chase assets because that's what the banks are set up to lend to. In the near term, you hear the headline inflation discussion of, you know, 5% inflation and so forth. Most of that is anomalous. That is, if you look at inflation on an annual basis since 2019, you'll find 2.25% inflation, not so bad. Nobody pushed prices last year because you just didn't know what was going to happen. Nobody pressed prices. They kind of said, let's see what's going to happen. Back to what we were talking about. You did it on your rents. You stayed steady. And then you found out, oh, I can push. So the push is coming this year for 2 years worth of. So that's one thing. And then the third, lumber caught a lot of attention. Answer was cut capacity, stop expanding capacity. So what happened is in certain sectors of the economy, like sawmills, capacity shrunk anywhere from 3% to 40%. If capacity shrunk 3 to 40% and demand rebounded to roughly where it was in 2019, what do you think happens to prices?
Prices going up.
Then what do you think happens thereafter? Eventually that capacity comes back online. So we've got inflation currently is complex, but inflation looking forward, look to asset price inflation.
Very exciting, very educational. I regret that our time is soon to come to an end. But if you would, please give us a wrap-up on your conclusion that this is the golden age for multifamily investing.
Look, you want to go into a sector where rent and occupancy look good moving forward, and multifamily fits that in almost every submarket, some more than others, and that's why you still have to do homework, right? Second, you want to go to where capital is predictably there, and that's back to the Freddie Fannie discussion. Third, you want to take advantage of cheap money, and Freddie Fannie being there means you have cheap debt relative to cap rates these days, which means you have good coverage and good cash flow. And last, but certainly not least, is this money that's come into the system is going to go somewhere. And I think multifamily is not going to be the only place it goes, but it's going to be one of the places. So where in your models, you're underwriting cap rates to be probably 50 basis points higher when you sell.
Exactly. 50 basis points.
They're going to be, if you sell 7 years from now, they're going to be 25 basis points lower. By the way, I'm underwriting the same as you, but I really think they're going to be lower. And that's because all the money. And then in the same way you were wrong on saying they were going to be 50 basis points higher when you bought in 2012 versus 2019, all of us are going to be wrong. Cap rates are lower because unprecedented amount of money creates unprecedented amount of capital flows, which creates unprecedented pricing. With that, thank you. It's been great fun.
Thank you, Dr. Litterman. That's very exciting.
Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining today's episode of The Real Estate Show, sponsored by Capital Square Realty Advisors. Please join me, Lewis Rogers, same time next week when we discuss cutting-edge real estate topics of interest locally and nationally. Living in the sweet Virginia
breeze. Sweet Virginia breeze. The Real Estate Show, sponsored by Capital Square Realty Advisors, LLC, is broadcast as an information service and includes opinions as to buying, selling, and holding various investments. However, the host, Lewis Rogers, is not licensed to give any financial, tax, or other investment advice or recommendations. Accordingly, any data and information discussed is provided for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not intended to be an offer or solicitation to invest in any particular investment. You should never make an investment decision based solely off the information discussed on this broadcast. If you are seeking investment, tax, or legal advice, you should consult with a registered investment advisor, financial, tax, or legal professional of your choosing. Opinions and views expressed on this broadcast are opinions and views based on research gathered through what we believe to be reputable sources. Although we believe these sources to be accurate and reliable, in no way do we represent or guarantee the accuracy thereof, nor the accuracy of the statements made on this broadcast. Listeners should independently verify all claims on this broadcast and conduct their own due diligence before investing in any securities or investments, including any mentioned on this broadcast. Investing in securities is highly speculative and carries a high degree of risk.